this week on Dig Me Out. With your hosts, Jason Ziak, Tim Minichi, and Chip Midnight.
Jay, we're back again with another episode thanks to our Dig Me Out Union on Patreon. You can help us make the next episode happen by joining us at dmounion.com or digmeoutunion.com. And we have a special guest joining us, Jay. We need to get him a badge, like a blazer and a badge with the microphone. So like, it looks like the guy from that would do like the investigative reportings for your local news.
The correspondent.
Yeah. Like have him with his hand to like a wind blowing in the background with his hand to the air.
Coming to you live from the streets of the 90s.
This there is you go.
Midnight investigative reporter.
Chip Midnight's helicopter back. In the background.
Yes.
Welcome back, Chip.
Hey, thanks for having me.
If you're here, we're either talking about 80s metal or you did an interview. And since we're not talking about 80s metal, that means you did an interview. So tell everybody.
I did an interview.
What'd you do?
So I interviewed Hobie Eklund from the band Majesty Crush.
Okay.
I'm seeing some blank stares, which I imagine is probably what a lot of listeners are also doing, the blank stare. You know, personally, I feel like this is fulfilling the mission of Dig Me Out. This is a band that put out one record on a subsidiary, on a child label of Elektra Records that was very small, had a couple big names on it, names that would become bigger down the road, but very small label and was sort of a one and done band. So you guys have never heard of Majesty Crush, I'm assuming.
I heard the name sounds familiar, but there could have been other bands with similar names with Majesty.
It's a pretty rad name.
So yeah. I don't want to, I feel like in these intros, I always spend a lot of time spoiling a lot of stuff that people say. So I'm not really going to go too much into it, but Hobie is the bass player. And the reason for this interview, this is a band that I was familiar with and that I actually saw play a show at a venue in Columbus that was just around a very brief time. It was a combination pizza place and a concert venue. It was called, it was called Freakin' Pizza. And it was around like in 92, 93. You guys at some point moved to Columbus, but I'm sure you've never heard of Freakin' Pizza.
We weren't there till 98. And heard the name. I don't know anything about it.
I'm pretty sure this was the only show I ever saw there. And I honestly, and you'll hear this in the interview, but I told Hobie that like, I don't even remember how I got turned on to Majesty Crush, but I was a big fan. They put out an EP first on their own. I'm trying to look to see if it has a name. It's just called The Fan and it's five songs. I am going to spoil this part. Hobie, when he described the band, said they were a Detroit band born and raised in the punk and Motown scenes. They had come from like a punk rock background, but they were a shoegazing band that sounded like they should be from England, playing in Detroit and featuring a black singer and a black drummer. So really like against the grain for anything you might expect coming out of Detroit. So it's not surprising that you two don't know Majesty Crush, but they're a very niche band and in that shoegaze world of the early 90s. And they've had a little bit of not notoriety, but they've been included on some like compilation albums that have come out over the years. Third Man Records put out a compilation album and used one of their songs in the last couple of years. And the Numero Group, you guys know that label? Numero Group sort of has two arms. They do like a lot of, they dig up all these old, like, all this old classic soul music from like smaller scenes that never became big bands, to put out like a single here and there, maybe a record on I think they might have put out something from a Columbus band from like the 60s, a soul band. So they've got that sort of arm of it and they reissue that stuff. And then they have recently been reissuing a lot of 90s music. So Karate was reissued, Duster was reissued on Numero Group. They put it out on like these really nice vinyl packages. They did the one, they put out that hair metal compilation in the last maybe year or two, like the LA scene hair metal stuff. I imagine if we pick that thing up, we would recognize maybe like one out of the 40 bands featured on that. Yeah. So they really, we got to get them on this show. I mean, they're really about digging stuff out too. But they are reissuing on March 28th. Basically the all-encompassing package that includes the EP that they put out on their own, which is called Fan, and then the Love 15 album. Love 15 I have on cassette, which I got for $1, a promo copy from Record Exchange in Cleveland.
And Record Exchange.
That was on Dolly Records, D-A-L-I, a subsidiary of Elektra. And Hobie is going to tell you all about what that label is, where it came from. I will, again, spoiler, I'll tell you that Dolly also had put up music by Lucinda Williams and Caius.
Okay.
That's a range.
It was a pretty diverse label. The guy who started it was in this band, Sonia Dada, and he was really interested in putting out music by musicians that he really liked, and it didn't really matter what the genre was. He wanted to put out good music. The one final thing I'll say is Majesty Crush, again, is kind of a shoegaze sound, but with a singer who grew up on like soul music and funk music and loved Prince. The lyrics are like not downright like R-rated or X-rated, but he definitely sings stuff that would make your grandmother blush a little bit. You know, he's very, very into that whole Prince. Hobie says that, you know, somebody like The Weeknd these days, had Majesty Crush been bigger, The Weeknd may have gone and said that was their influence, because that was the kind of music he sang.
Interesting.
Also, a little side note, and he mentioned it briefly in the interview, and I'm not going to go too much into it, but the singer David really, really struggled with mental health issues, especially later on after the band broke up. Untreated mental health issues, moved around a lot, didn't have a permanent address, wasn't able to refill prescriptions and stuff like that, and met a very tragic ending due to a mental health crisis issue. It made TMZ.com, not because of who he was, but because basically it was a incident with the LA police where he was brandishing some sort of sword or something during a mental health crisis. And the cops saw him with the sword and ended up shooting and killing him in 2017. Wow. So kind of a tragic end to David's life. But this is a lengthy one, but I promise you it'll be time well spent, because Hobie, while his band only put out an album and an EP, he eventually became a music writer. So he's written for like the Village Voice. He told me some other things he'd written for. I think he had something published once in Rolling Stone. So he's got some just tremendous stories and some really amazing 90s stories. He was kind of a firsthand participant in the 90s, but then also able to go back and look at the 90s. And so he's got a lot of really great stories.
Awesome. Well, it sounds like a cool band too.
Yeah.
Very unique combination of styles.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh, sorry, one more thing. I'll say that this interview just started fast and furious. There was no real introduction, so we're just gonna start to jump right into it. There wasn't a welcome to the podcast kind of thing. We just started talking as soon as the Zoom call started, and I never thought to go back and be like, hey, we need to record an opening. So we'll just jump right in.
Good.
Okay, everybody. Get ready.
We're jumping in.
And jump. Thanks, Chip.
Yep. Seven hundred episodes, and I don't see them slowing down. Like, there's so much stuff that came out in the 90s.
There was so much stuff that just, it was that one big record. And now they're kind of in dribs and drabs, like the quicksands of the worlds and the failures of the worlds kind of coming back, and you can read their Wikipedia pages. But there were those bands. I mean, my God, there was one from Canada called the Gandharvas that had a song called First Day of Spring that was like, it sounded like Take Five by Dave Brubeck, but as alternative, it was amazing. Yes. And we had a Canadian content station across the way. That's where Majesty Crush got all our airplay from. And for Canadian content, they'd have to play one Canadian band every hour. Well, come springtime, right around now, that song was on heavy rotation. And I finally found somebody in Canada who burned me a copy of the CD. None of it's on Spotify, Apple Music, nowhere, no one knows, nothing. And that's just the way it worked back then, man. It just came and went.
I'm not positive, but I feel like that, I don't think they've reviewed that album, but I know that album, they have, I was not familiar. I never used Discord before
mm-hmm.
the whole thing.
No, that's huge, yeah.
And so they do a whole Patreon thing where people, you know, pay money every month and they get to be part of the private Discord for Dig Me Out. And that band has come up a few times. It's like, hey, don't forget about this band. You should review it.
I would gladly pay to find out what the hell happened. I have the Burn CD to my right. I do not own a CD player right now. I'm looking at the envelope. I am not joking. A Canadian guy who collected a lot of Crush vinyl. I said, hey, man, I have to ask you, you're Canadian. You know a lot of obscure music. Ken Darvis. He's like, it never came out on vinyl. I have the CD. I'll burn you a copy. That's the only reason I have it.
Absolutely amazing.
It's a language, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, absolutely. You know, that's how Northern Soul came out. You know what Northern Soul is, right? And it's actually something the Numero label taps into very well. There was this bizarre trend in England that in Manchester and in the North of liking soul that was from deliberately obscure American labels, like not Motown, not Stax, not the major ones, but obscure regional stuff. And they sought out the more underground indie funk and soul, which is what made it highly collectible. But it's an entire genre of appreciation in Northern England in the 70s and 80s that was about finding, even the 60s as well, but it was becoming fans of the non-obvious, obscure funk and soul that was coming out of America. Numero has some of its biggest sellers are in that Northern Soul umbrella. It's interesting. It's fascinating to me.
Yeah, I'm not sure. So I live in Columbus, Ohio, and I think that they might have put out something from exactly what
I'm sure they did.
About. Yeah.
I'm sure they did. I'm a journalist, as you know, as well. I wrote an article. It was called Downriver Revival. It was about a factory worker in Downriver, Detroit, who worked for Ford. And in his basement, he set up a recording studio and he invented a weird version of like a Hawaiian slide guitar. And he recorded what he thought was going to be gospel music that would have a crossover. And part of the reason they decided to do the reissue is that one of the songs he recorded when it did come out in the early 70s was a Northern Soul classic. So just based on this niche success of this one record, we have this whole compilation called Downriver Revival, which is this gospel label in a guy's basement where he thought he'd have a crossover hit. It's fascinating to me. It's totally fascinating. This is all pre-internet too, man. This is all pre-internet. You know what I mean? That's the part about it that gets me. I mean, you know it better than I do. All these bands and stuff. Like, how did you discover Majesty Crush?
That was 30 years ago, and I don't exactly remember, but I got the EP.
Right, the fan EP. Yeah,
and I bought a promo copy of 15 cassette. Yeah, and I saw you in Columbus, Ohio, at a place called Freakin' Pizza, which was a
pizza. I remember that. Yeah, it was an AIDS benefit. I remember it. The first night of our tour. I remember it well. I forget the band we played with. They were kind of characters. They would weightlift in their van before the gig. But I remember that gig very well. It was at a pizza parlor. It was a benefit show. And it was for like an AIDS benefit. It was the first year of it. And I remember Dave, it wasn't the most conventional rock and roll place to play from what I remember.
No, not at all.
It was kind of more like a student meeting place. And we happened to be the band there. And I know Dave took that bait and kind of ran with it. He was a little drunk and a little confrontational. Yeah, I remember that gig. I remember everything about it. I even remember in the newspaper, the article about it, because whoever put the show on was like, hey, we got press. And there was a guy who was in character as like a Greek thespian or something in a toga. And he was totally in character in the picture. And I remember seeing that. And it was just, I don't know why. I think it was because the first night of our tour, our record had maybe just come out. It was before our record company folded. And we're like, man, we're playing Columbus, Ohio. We're playing in Columbus, Ohio. We get there and it's like, it's a pizza place. It's an AIDS benefit. It was a little off, but I don't know what you remember about the show, but we were a band that tended to thrive on those kinds of I mean, that's the name of the band, Majesty Crush. It's like having an expectation that it's somehow pushed aside or changed because of the reality.
Yeah.
But I remember that. I remember that gig very, very well. That's hilarious.
I don't remember the gig so well. I just remember, I mean, I definitely went to see you. I don't know. I was writing for a local like alternative monthly music magazine. I don't know. Mm-hmm. If, I don't know if a publicist reached out. I don't know if we got a copy of something, a CD or a cassette in the mail, but I definitely, I specifically went to see you. I don't remember much about the gig. I do know the guy that owned the place. I don't know. I was just thinking about this today and I don't know why I remember this. His name was Kirby. Uh-huh. And, yeah. He was from a real small town about an hour north of here, like a one stoplight kind of town that's out in the farmland area. And my cousin actually either worked for him in a restaurant or opened a restaurant with him or somehow knew him.
Wow.
And you know, the whole thing is like Kirby went to Ohio State and opened this pizza place and he's bringing rock bands to that. It was, you know, small town kid.
It's that's the way it worked back then though. That's what I can't tell you how many shows we did either in a record store or in a restaurant where it was just anywhere you could get people together pre-internet, you know?
Yeah.
We even played like house parties. We played, I forget, but the maybe two or three gigs after that, we played in the middle of winter. It was a band called the Mighty Purple. They were a very popular pop band. And the other band on the bill, talk about your one hit wonders, where are they now, was the Smoking Popes. Do you remember the Smoking Popes? They had that song, I Need You Around. It sounded like Frank Sinatra and Weezer. You know, you probably don't remember the song.
They played in Columbus. They were here two nights ago in Columbus.
Okay, well, so we're on the exact same page with this. But we played, and this was a kid owned an indoor skate park or had access to it. It was an all-ages gig in the middle of winter at an all-ages skate park at night. And it was this band, the Mighty Purple, the Smoking Popes, and us. And am I mentioning also that this is in the middle of a Midwestern winter?
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? I mean, that's the kind of stuff. And there was nobody taking pictures. There was nobody, right? You know, I mean, Columbus would have been a major city we were playing back then. It was just like stuff just happened. And, you know, these bands, it was just miraculous. You could make it from one town to the next sometimes, you know? So I remember the next night we played Akron, we played Youngstown. And Youngstown was in this kind of weird punk rock bar and they were showing like Faces of Death before we went on. And it was just really clear. It was more of like a rock heavy metal place. And of course, Dave went into Dave mode on that one too. But I mean, that was what it was like back then. You didn't have the luxury now where there's an entire shoegaze scene,
right?
Where shoegaze bands, I mean, there's this festival going on right now. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's called Slide Away, which is based on my favorite Verve song two off of Storm of Heaven. I can play it for you right now, note for note. But that's an entire tour. It's a festival. It's in LA next weekend or two weekends from now. But it's all these shoegaze bands from across the country. And it's phenomenal.
Yeah.
You know, this would have been unheard of 30 years ago. You were lucky to get 10 bands that could get radio play on the alternative radio station. You know, you had like the Breeders, Weezer, 311. I'm trying to think some of the also-rans. You had every local band that was kind of doing the alternative rock thing. It was hard to find six or seven bands that could play on the same bill, you know, but that just, that's what it was like, you know. It kind of made you feel like you earned it back then, didn't it though?
Absolutely.
If you could find a band and pursue it and go see them, like you felt like you were like mining for gold, you know, it was like special.
I say this all the time. I work with a lot of people that are 20, 30 years younger than me. And I say all the time that on one hand, having every song in recorded history in the palm of my hand is the most magical gift I've ever gotten because I can just check things out. On the other hand, there was a club in Columbus at that time called Stashes. And I don't know what the Detroit comparison was. It was the 200 person place that every alternative band that eventually blew up in 93, 94 played on their first, like I saw Nirvana.
Yeah, yeah. Like so in Detroit, it was called St. Andrews Hall. In Chicago, it was called Metro. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, but this place was smaller. I've been to Metro.
About half the
probably
size,
more like
right, yeah.
Magic Stick. Is that a Detroit club?
Okay, yes. I would actually, that's a wonderful comparison. Magic Stick, yes.
And I tell the story all the time that there was a local band called Greenhorn, and they were very much like a Neil Young meets Dinosaur Jr., like a Midwest rock, but with big amplifiers. And it was sort of magical to see them. You'd go to Stash's at the, like, I would always go like the first week of the month, and they would handwrite their calendar on a poster board and post it up.
Yeah.
And then I would write down on a piece of paper, I need to come back next Friday and the Tuesday after that to come see these bands.
Yeah.
They usually, the Greenhorn especially, packed the place, but you couldn't, we didn't have phones to record stuff. So if you wanted to hear those songs, you had to see them live once a month. Yeah. Otherwise, they weren't recording anything. So that was the only way to hear them. And there was something, and there was something bands, magical.
And a lot of those bands too didn't quite know how to navigate like a recording studio. And if they did, sometimes it was not an environment that was as electric, obviously, as their live performances. I'll go to the very first, what was the one, the very first Soul Asylum record, the one that was on Twin Tone.
Oh yeah,
out of Minneapolis. It was, you know, I saw Soul Asylum play with Husker Du. I was like, this sounds like the MC5. This is the greatest band I've ever seen. I go by their record and it sounded like it was recorded in a dentist office, because you could tell here's a great live band that had to show up at 10 in the morning and listen to drum sounds for an hour while the engineer dialed it in. Then they played everything to a click track, and it just sucked the life out of the recording.
Yeah.
You know, but you're 1,000% correct. The way we experienced music was live, you know, and that's one of the things too, that was kind of interesting. It's like Majesty Crush. We all came out of like punk rock. My first hardcore show was seeing the Bad Brains in 1982. I met Odell singing. I was singing for a hardcore band, my brother's hardcore band, Zug Island Convicts, my one and only gig. Odell was the only kid who showed up from the punk scene that wasn't like a direct friend of ours. And that's how we all knew each other. But that was the caliber of music we were expecting. When your first punk gig is Bad Brains.
Yeah.
And you grow up and on the radio, it's the best of the best of the best of Motown. It's the best FM radio. You know, it's Bowie next to like Jethro Tull and Pink Floyd. But it's all like the best music ever. You're just, you're so used to things being at a certain level. And if anything, there was a beauty to being able to experience stuff in what you were presumptively thinking was like its best and top form. You know what I mean? If those bands were having a bad night, I wouldn't know. You know what I'm trying to say? Like, I don't know if you know much about the Bad Brains live. You can find them on YouTube, but Bad Brains in 82, 83, Dave Grohl on VH1 History of Punk said they were the best effing live band of all time, period. Yeah. You know, and that was like, that was my introduction to what a live band was capable of, you know? And I mean, that was something else too, is the energy there. It wasn't always captured on records, and it wasn't captured in how big a show was. It was captured by your experience of it. And if you were sharing it with 20, 30, or in some cases, 200 people, you were like, man, we are a part of something magic. We weren't thinking about it like that then. You realize now, you were like, that was like proof of God. You know what I'm saying?
Oh yeah. Did so it sounds like you were listening to that stuff and into that kind of music, like pre-college, like maybe at early teens?
Yeah, I mean, I was like that kid who had a subscription to Rolling Stone magazine in seventh and eighth grade. So I thought I was super cool reading about all these musicians. And I started to get into, like, I remember I took out from my public library The Doors' Greatest Hits, and that's how I discovered The Doors. And then we had great public radio in Detroit, and I would tape like a reggae show off of that. We had a band called Maka Rhythm Tribe, and I remember they played live on the public radio station WDET 101.9, and I recorded it on my little radio cassette. And I was like a badass because I had a live reggae thing. I loved reggae. I loved reggae. Reggae to me was like, it had the same rhythm as Motown. But yeah. And I later learned they were completely related. But I didn't know it at the time. But it just really struck me. And so I was into stuff intensely. And I also joined the Columbia Record and Tape Club for a penny. So I had, you know, the 12 classic rock records everybody had back then. I got... You know, I remember the first 7-inch I ever bought was Chic Le Freak. And I had I had that Endless Summer Beach Boys compilation that I loved. I just love listening to that over and over again. And this is before I knew anything about music. I couldn't tell you what a key was. I still can't. But my point was, you know, one thing about growing up in suburban Detroit, you had the best radio. You had access to all this music. And like I said, like Detroit was a huge punk rock stop. there were punk bands that played in Detroit that never played anywhere else. The Misfits' last show with Glenn Danzig was basically Halloween, October 29th, 1983. I was there with my brothers. I skipped my senior year homecoming dance to go see the Misfits. And they were covering Black Flag. They had the drummer from the Necros, Todd Swalla, playing. It's on video. You can find it on YouTube. But it was literally an historical event. So, yeah, we were all into that stuff. And then we started to get into the more post-punk stuff. And that's when we really started to, I think, see the possibilities of music. I really loved Scratch Acid, which is the band that was before the Jesus Lizard.
Yeah.
I just love them. And I love Butthole Surfers. They would play Detroit because their label, Touch and Go Records, was in Detroit at the time. So they would play Detroit twice a month, crisscrossing the country on tours. So it sounds really weird to say, but the Butthole Surfers were like the house band of the Detroit hardcore scene. You could see them twice a month without thinking about it, you know, and it was incredible. And we go to all these shows in Black Flag, you know, the Slip It In tour, the My War tours, when they were like just super heavy. And, you know, I would see Odell. I knew everybody from that scene. And as I think you know, when we started to buy the really cool records at the really cool record store called Play It Again Records, the clerk, you know, straight out of the movie High Fidelity, the cool clerk, the tastemaker, who'd be like, you want to check this out, was a gentleman by the name of Michael Siegel, who, you know, 4 years later would wind up becoming our guitar player.
Oh, wow.
So if it seems impossibly perfect that we were all not friends, but we were all fans of the same music.
Yeah.
I was living with Dave Strotter after college. We never thought about a band, but he came back from Play It Again Records and he had that album by A.R. Kane called 69. He's like, yeah, Michael, the record store guy, sold me this. And we're listening to this and we're like, this sounds like Jesus and Mary Chain if they love dub reggae. This is incredible. And we often cite A.R. Kane as one of our biggest influences for the kind of erotic lyrics, the more dubby, heavier rhythm section qualities of what we do, but also having a foot and shoe gaze. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Almost like erotic shoe gaze. And I can't emphasize how natural it was that we all were into the same music and we all knew each other before we were in a band. I mean, as you probably know, I was in a band with Odell. At the very end, he had a band called Spawn Ranch, which was the coolest, weirdest band in Detroit. It was like Jane's Addiction, but way moodier and spookier. It was Odell playing percussion. It was a guitar player playing a drone through delay pedal and on a 12-string guitar, and a singer who could do this like Perry Farrell choir boy type singing. And I was just their biggest fan. And then they invited me to join in 1987. And I just kind of like, I mirrored some of the guitar lines and we wrote some stuff. And then that band kind of had its course because it ended after college ended. And then, you know, Odell and I knew each other. And then through 2-3 years later, he and Dave are living together. And it's like, hey, let's start a band. It's like, hey, let's, you know, I mean, Dave was the one who turned me on when I was in college before we were even in band. He turned me on to Syd Barrett. You know, he gave me a tape of the Madcap Laughs. You know, I knew about as much about Pink Floyd as the average music person did. I wasn't aware about the whole Syd Barrett thing. Dave turned me on to all of that. And then Dave turned me on to like X-Mail, Deutschland, and some of the deeper stuff on the 4AD record label, right?
Yeah.
And it was just like, whoa, there's a whole world out there. But we weren't in a band yet, you know? That's what was so cool about it.
With the bands that you were in, though, the Spawn Ranch, was it a were there the rock star dreams? I mean, were you not at all?
No. Well, it was a known thing. Brad was on a fast track to do amazing things. Bradley went on to be one of the heads of Yahoo and Google. Bradley is a tech giant. He's semi-retired now. So we always knew the band was something we were going to do until we graduated college. Odell was actually a TV presenter. He was a personality on a children's show called Club Connect that was on the public radio or public television station.
To the music, and the music is you. So plug on in. Here's what we're going to do.
Coming up on Club Connect, Odell Nails is on the road in a foreign country. Stay tuned to find out where.
Bob, our singer, worked a bunch of jobs, but he actually wound up going to nursing school. So we never, ever thought of it like in a careerist way. You know, we were just, we knew a lot of people. So we got really cool gigs like opening for the Swans and Psychic TV. And we played a lot with like Laughing Hyenas. But we were like this cool, low budget 4AD type band that would play with these much harder, more aggressive bands. The you might have been familiar, there was this really snarky but brilliant fanzine out of the University of Michigan called Motor Booty.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And those guys were all in the band. They were affiliated with the band Big Chief and the Necros. But we lived with one of the guys, this writer named Mike Rubin. And, you know, Mike was the kind of guy, his mom would come and, like, bring him cookies and help him with his laundry once a week. But he was a really, he was a great writer. And he called a Spawn Ranch new age music for people with black leather jackets. It was pretty right on, right?
Yeah.
We definitely were more melodic and we didn't mind being darkly beautiful. And because we didn't have traditional, like Odell was playing drums on his knees, it was very, it just had a novelty to it, which was refreshing. You know, it didn't sound like, okay, the drummer's too loud, the bass, and it didn't look or sound conventional. It just could kind of happen, which today would sound sort of gimmicky, but back then it kind of worked.
Yeah.
You know? And then out of that band, that's how we formed Majesty Crush. And it's very interesting because, you know, basically Odell and I are a rhythm section. We're the most accomplished people in the band. Dave and Odell are friends from high school who are then living together. And Michael is this guy that all these years has been selling us these records that we love. And then we finally are a band together. So, I mean, it plays out so like a movie script. It's so simple, you know, but it was that small, a smaller world back then. We just happened to all kind of fall into each other's orbits at the right time. You know, if you talk, because you have the fan CD, our idea was very simple. When we recorded a 7-inch, we knew it was a 7-inch record. We knew it was going to sound very small. We knew it was going to be very small. We recorded on a very low budget with Mikey Clark, who's, you know, best known for producing Insane Clown Posse, Primal Scream, and Kid Rock. But he was also our friend, and he was a friend of Spawn Ranch's. He recorded Spawn Ranch as well. But, you know, when we made a 7-inch, it sounded like a 7-inch. It was very lo-fi. It was sweet. It was shiny. It was a cute record you would put on. You would turn it over, and you'd say, that was a perfectly baked little teeny musical, you know, appetizer. Like we definitely nailed what a 7-inch should look and sound like. Very delicate, very perfunctory, and done. And then with Fan, we were like, what if we do 5 songs? Well, they've got to be different sounding, and they've got to cover a lot of things. So that's why Fan has number one Fan, but then it has Penny for Love, which is kind of a straightforward pop song, albeit about a guy who becomes a prostitute so we can hang out with a prostitute. That's Dave. And then it has the song Worry, which is one of Dave's best songs ever. It's just about being alive as a person. It's my daughter, my 15-year-old daughter's favorite song by us, because I think it's the most identifiable one, that, you know, you're always going to worry about something. And then we had a song called Horse that, through no fault of our own, was about a good friend of ours who happened to be going through addiction. And we were a band that was definitely touched by addiction and have addiction histories and things like this. So, you know, we just made the best record we could. And it just happened to have 5 very different songs that all were very kind of mature. And then the song Number One Fan got on the radio because it was a good song. It was kind of half speed, so you could sing along to it. And it was right around the time Catherine Wheel had that song Black Metallic, was sort of similar in the sense that it was a slower song that got louder. And, you know, that's the whole thing. You know, your original question was did you have any ambition or anything? We did, but it was always to be like a really cool little record that a few people would really love. And if it didn't go beyond that, that was fine.
Yeah.
You know, Dave was getting fan mail from girls in high school sending him like candy heart boxes and stuff like that. You know, those were the kind of fans we were getting, people who really, really liked what we did. And I was very aware you weren't going to get like huge audiences doing something that was that emotional, that obsessional, that dark, and that kind of moody, you know. But that was the music we all loved. So we were cool with it, you know. And that's what was so funny. Like when we had a major label record, we suddenly had a budget. We'd go into this huge studio. We're recording through the Doobie Brothers mixing board. You know what I mean? You know what I mean, man? Like Michael McDonald's graced that thing. And I think we did a good job with it. You know, we had these great producers, the Nera brothers that were from, you know, the same suburb I was. And they knew how to take our songs and say, hey, what would your song sound like if you had like the greatest recording equipment from the 70s that say Pink Floyd recorded on? What would happen if your songs could be done in a studio with all the freedom that Pink Floyd had? And that's what they did, you know? And we have Love 15 to show for it. But it wasn't like we ever aspired to that at all, you know, at all. In fact, one thing the major label process did with us is it made us realize that the songs that we thought we did the best with in the studio are the songs Feigned Sleep and Horse, which are kind of like the most quiet, obscure, like you'll listen to them late at night in your headphones type music. Like we knew those weren't going to be radio hits. Those are going to be super deep cuts people would like put on mixtapes and stuff back when people did such a thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And then we recorded the other half of the record at a studio called The Temper Mill because Dave Feeney, the producer, and again, Mike Clark, that's where we recorded with Mike Clark, but now we were in the main room. We knew we could just play the songs very straight ahead and get them out there. But we weren't looking to like, you know, we didn't think in terms of like, wow, this is going to be a hit or anything. We just wanted to make a better version of music that we've been making that we feel would reach an audience, but maybe not a big audience.
Yeah.
You know, we always wanted quality over quantity because that was the way we were we were always fans of bands like that. You know, like even Nirvana, like we knew about Nirvana from the early 7 inches and stuff, you know, like the Bleach era stuff.
Yeah.
You know, because all these punk rock bands from Detroit would bring back and they go, man, there's this thing happening in the Pacific Northwest. These bands all sound like Black Sabbath, you know, and we're like, what? And we're listening to these records and we're like, this is amazing. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
And that's what I think was really funny was that Dave was a total star. And I listen now to Love 15, and I think there's great pop songs on that record, like Penny for Love and Uma are very straight-ahead pop songs. Number One Fan is a great pop song, albeit about very, very dark obsession. But it's not like we went out of our way to be more commercial, you know? And if you look at any of the YouTube live videos of us playing, Dave was often very confrontational. And he was a total character on stage. Like he stalked the stage, you know?
Yeah.
I would say our biggest, you know, comparison would be like Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. You know what I mean? Kind of a churning rhythm section and a singer just coming out in front of it and going crazy.
Yeah.
You know?
Did you guys release the EP on your own?
Yeah, that was totally. It was Dave's parents helped us finance it. You know, we arranged the cover photograph when Michael's girlfriend, Carrie Kelly, the lady on the cover is Julia Cole, good friend of ours. In the back picture where we're walking along, it's in Chicago on our first trip there. It was taken by my girlfriend at the time. And, you know, just completely naively, we were like, we're going to put out an EP. Now, we did have the advantage of knowing the best record store in the city. So we knew people were going to sell. We could drop 10 or 20 CDs off and they were going to sell. And we could sell them at gigs. The miracle was Number One Fan got on the radio I mean, it got on the real radio. Right. We started off at the late night show. We're like, we're going to have an hour of local bands, which was great. I mean, even that was amazing. But then the program director said, you know, this is good enough. We could put this on the real radio. Like, we could put this like during the day. You could be hearing this at 10 in the morning.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And number one fan got on the radio, and it, which was a miracle. It was a total miracle. Like, it was unheard of that a local band would have a song on the radio, like the regular radio, right, which we now know is much, you know, much more about promotional budgets and whatever. But back then it was a Canadian radio station. I don't think they had huge, you know, they were playing alternative rock, right? So all the bands we opened for, you know, Jesus Jones, the Soup Dragons, Curve, Chapter House, Mazzy Star, they were all in regular rotation. And the program director said, why not Majesty Crush? They're the band that plays with these guys all the time, and they have a good song, you know? And we were as surprised as everybody else.
know? Right.
You know?
Was signing with the offshoot of Elektra, was that a result of Nirvana becoming big? Were you part of the major label?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can describe the entire early 90s music industry is saying, look, an obscure band on an obscure label that writes good songs has the potential to become a huge band, especially if their sound is gently produced for a wider audience. Mm-hmm. That was the Nirvana formula. I love what Butch Vig would say, though. People would want to record with him at his studio, and they'd say, make us sound like Nirvana. And he would say, without missing a beat, you better write as good a songs as they do. And I totally believe that. We had an A&R guy who was interested in us and one other band. If you're talking about obscure bands, it was a band called The Smashing Orange. Okay. Now, I know what you're going to say, especially in this day of search engine optimization. A band with the name Smashing Orange isn't going to go very far in a world where there is the Smashing Pumpkins. But it was basically the big bands that were on this label were Bleach from England, which was kind of a mellower version of Curve. It was a cool female singer and kind of vaguely shoegazy. Mm-hmm. And it was cool. And then Smashing Orange, which was this great alternative rock band with a very charismatic singer. And then it was us. And the cool thing was the label wasn't based on everything sounding the same. It was actually based on, we want the coolest music in all these different genres. So check this out. Check out our label mate, Lucinda Williams, you know, alt country goddess, Ultramarine, which is all you need to know is they're the sampling little dance band from the UK that sampled Echo and the Bunnymen. So it was one of the best things I've ever heard, because Echo and the Bunnymen is one of my favorite bands of all time. And then a little band from the desert, Palm Desert, called Caius, that quickly turned into a band you might know by their new name, Queens of the Stone Age.
Yes.
So we were like, wow, we are in really good company here. This is really cool. And, you know, other labels had expressed interest. And frankly, if we had our way, we would have wanted to be on like a 4AD, a really cool label, like in England, or Creation Records. But it just wasn't in the cards at the time.
Yeah.
The only label we did talk to was ARC, which is A.R. Kane's label, but nothing came of it. But that's very telling, because that would have been like our dream label, right?
Yeah.
But the thing was, the label that was interested in us was a label that was interested in a lot of really cool bands that didn't fit in exactly with everything else. Caius was part of a desert generator rock scene, what we'd now call stoner rock. But they were kind of in their own league at the time. Lucinda Williams is a legend, you know? She's the Stevie Nicks of Nashville. That's mm-hmm. all there is to it. And we were just like, wow, this is a cool label. We'll get a lot of attention. And it just seemed like the right thing at the time. And what we learned very quickly afterwards was, you can get on a label, but you need a manager and you need a lawyer to kind of keep your interest front and center. And we didn't have those things. We opted somewhat stupidly to go with a music lawyer in Chicago rather than one in New York. And so when the label went out of business, they weren't great at getting us, you know, our contract bought out or anything else. We just sort of let it die. also not having good management, we were going around by ourselves trying to get signed again, and we just looked very non-professional.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
back then there were, you know, the one thing the Nirvana signing frenzy did is it created a lot of really great independent booking agencies, management agencies, and legal firms. And we just weren't on the inside of that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We just didn't quite have it. And, you know, to be honest, it never really felt right being on a major label. And I don't say that because I don't know how to put it, but it was like, we got it. But looking back on it now, like we were very naive, like recording half our record in basically a classic rock studio and the other half in a more familiar studio where we could just be more straight ahead and live. That was a good choice, but it was maybe not one we would have made had we been further along with like more a more hands-on manager or a more hands-on, even more hands-on legal or whatever. We were kind of left to do the do our own thing that we'd been doing up till then, which was choose all our own stuff. And we did, and we did the best job we could. But we kind of learned the hard way. When you're in the major label world, at some level, you got to bring on other people with your interests in mind. And so that was a little strange, you know?
So I interviewed the band Ivy. And
oh, yeah.
They, when I talked to them, they said that they signed to, I think it was called Seed Records.
Yep.
And Seed was a like a boutique mm-hmm. label off Atlantic. Was and they said that like all the money came back up through Atlantic. Was Dolly like, was it supposed to, was Dolly pretending to be an indie label that had major label backing? Or
no,
or
it's actually the total irony. It's the total exact opposite. There's a guy named Dan Pritzker who's wonderful. He's the heir, one of the heirs to the Hyatt Hotel fortune. He runs a huge philanthropic thing. I think he has a brother who's very involved in politics. He had a band called Sonia Dada. They were like Was Not Was. They were a bunch of white guys playing soul and funk with a really, really cool African-American singer. They had a huge hit in Australia. And he basically formed the label to put out his band. And based on his band's success, they partnered with Elektra to create other versions of that. Because again, a band that didn't really fit in. If you know what Was Not Was is, it was a band from Detroit that was a bunch of white funk and soul guys with these two old black guys singing that became adopted by like the no wave scene in New York, which is bizarre, but true. And Don Was, of course, is now one of the greatest music producers of all time. So this label was kind of, it was part of a boutique, almost a vanity project, but it actually had Elektra Music's distribution and backing. And there was technically three labels. It was Dolly Chameleon and then Elektra. So as far as the way this stuff worked, it gets really, really simple. And I'm sure Ivy would tell the same story. After a while, these labels just realize they're spreading themselves too thin and it's hard to keep track of what's doing what. And if these things aren't performing well, they just let them go. And basically what Elektra did is they dissolved all their sub-labels, not just ours, all of them. And they did it all at once. And this is just how the music industry worked in the early 90s. It was, you know, hey, with a little more money, this could do this. And with a little more distribution, this could do this. And then they just decided, you know what? Only one or two of these things is taking off. We have all this music that's being made. Some of it's very, very good, but we just didn't have the bandwidth to make sure that it's all successful. And so they just let it go. And frankly, from a business standpoint, I kind of don't blame them because everybody was just spread way too thin, you know? But that's the way this stuff worked, you know? And we all know there were those bands like Ween, you know, that got on Elektra proper. And it was always the weirdest thing in the world. They made the weirdest records.
Yes.
But they were on a major label. And somehow it worked. They had great videos. Dave Strotter still says Chocolate and Cheese is, I mean, you know, he's passed away, but he said Chocolate and Cheese was one of his favorite records of all time. And you're talking about a guy who loved a lot of music. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I respect it, but you know, we were, you can't underestimate what outsiders we were. Okay. I mean, I'm just going to go to the first thing is we were a band from Detroit that sounded British with black guys. Okay. That's the first part. The second part is Dave's lyrics sound like Prince times The Weeknd with a little bit of Syd Barrett. They're very erotic. They're very dark. He could be very intense and confrontational. He could also be very swoony and earnest. Songs like Worry, songs like Brand. And those are all great qualities today. But I think back then, it was kind of like, it could be as off-putting as it was attractive, you know? I remember reviews going, what's with this guy's obsessions, you know? And today, we would say, wow, that's somebody really getting in touch with himself, whatever. But back then, you know, people were writing kind of these sarcastic anthems, you know? A huge thing of grunge, as you know, was this kind of anti-hero, was a star that didn't want to be a star. You know what I'm trying to say?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, Dave was definitely in a totally different ballpark. So we were always aware that it was like, I remember we played a festival, I want to say in Ohio, might have even been Bowling Green for God's sake, but we played with the band called Belly. You know Belly?
Yeah, yeah.
Tanya from Throwing Muses solo band. She was in, I think she was in the Breeders for a minute.
Yep.
And I remember the morning afterwards, she goes to me, she says, I think you're the only person in your band who doesn't need therapy. Because, you know, Dave had gotten drunk and it was a great show, but he was definitely, you know, Belly are a band that would get up at 7 a.m. to go jogging. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We were a band besides me that would probably be getting to bed at about 7 a.m.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, like I said, you know, Belly knew what it meant to be a professional band. We did too, but I think we were really emotional and we had a certain, I'd say, as far as the business end of it was concerned, we were slightly immature.
Yes.
You know, we actually took it very personally when the record company went out of business. That's why the record we did after that called Sans Muscle has two of the hardest songs we ever wrote. It has a song called Sane, and it has a song called If JFA Were Still Together, which are, relatively speaking, they're closer for us. They're closer to Rage Against the Machine than they are to like My Bloody Valentine. They were way more hard and direct and in your face.
Yeah.
And it expressed our frustration, you know? And that's the thing. We were almost too, like I said, we were kind of immature. We didn't mask our emotions. Dave would always say exactly what was on his mind. And it created this character that was lovable, but you could definitely tell there was something more going on that could at times become troubling. And I think that's what made for such great music, but also such volatile personalities. And, you know, in the long run led to the band not being like, you know, hey, we're just going to keep going on no matter what. You know, it just got to the point we were just too emotional. You know, we were too combustible.
I do want to go back. You mentioned something that has come up on the Dig Me Out Discord quite a bit recently. Somebody was actually posing the question about whether or not anybody actually bought a Was Not Was record, especially the one with Walk the Dinosaur, new. Like, did anybody go to the store and buy that?
You know what, man? That is a great question. I remember that video. Like, I remember everything about that video. I would say, yeah, because it's probably right at the dawn of the CD.
Yeah.
You know, I remember when that record came out. But I know what you're trying. I know what you're saying. There were these bands back then that were more popular than they were high selling.
Yeah.
And it had to do with many different things. It could do with the fact that you could access this music on the radio and on video, but you didn't think to actually own it. You know, the fan base was perhaps bigger than the record buying. But that's an excellent, excellent point. And I think that's something about that industry. It's like you and I are talking about, you would go see the Greenhorn band play to 200 people and it'd be packed. But it wasn't like you had all their records and they were putting out all this music. You were going there to hear the experience there. And that was your understanding and appreciation of that music.
Yeah.
And that's something I think the 90s music industry got very, very wrong. And it shouldn't surprise anybody that the music industry is about selling music. But we now know today there's so many more and different ways that music gets popular. Now, as you may know, I also have a career as a writer. I wrote I ghost wrote an autobiography of a little group called the Insane Clown Posse. And as you know, the Insane Clown Posse are a group that has never really been taken seriously, and commercially, they've never done well at a major label level, but they're the kind of band that has an audience. So maybe their records only sell 50 or 100,000 copies, but every one of those people also buys every shirt, goes to every show. They go to the Gathering of the Juggalos. They collect everything they can that the band can put out. That's something that was totally lost on the music industry back then, was the quality of the fan. And so, that's something, to your point about did anybody own a Was Not Was record originally when it came out? I don't know. But all I know is that that seemed like a song that was specifically made to have a cool video that you'd hear on the record, that you'd hear on the radio, but it wasn't like everybody was marching to the record store to buy it. And that's nothing to say bad about the song. It was just a great radio song. I think we assume radio makes you buy a record. It doesn't.
Yeah.
It doesn't. What makes you buy a record is that you love a band and you want to learn more about them. You want to participate more in their world. Well, like I said, you know, we would play these little shows. You know, we're on our way to South by Southwest. We played at a coffee shop. And I remember there was some squabbling in the band about whether it was cool enough to play it. It was like an open mic. We wound up selling like 10 CDs and 10 t-shirts. We made more money playing at an open mic at a coffee house than we did on most of the gigs on that tour.
Yeah.
Because if we did get an audience, we got somebody who got really into us. And I think that's what's changed now. We have the quality of the fan has changed very much so. Yeah. It's a much deeper level. It's a more conversational level. I'll tell you the craziest thing, man, and Ohio plays into this as well. Since Crush has come out, I've been contacted by three different entities through Instagram. These are people in their 20s, maybe early 30s. One of them is a guy who's the bass player in a noise rock band here in Long Beach called Future Corpse. It's just random that he happens to live and play, I'm not joking, a five-minute bicycle ride from me. I've heard their music and I'm shocked they like our music, but I'm very touched. The singer and the bass player have contacted me. I'm going to go see them next Tuesday. Then there's a band from Southeast Ohio. It's rural Ohio called Ash Hollow. Again, super heavy, kind of crazy acoustic guitar that turns into whatever. Mm-hmm. And they love us. They love it for the emotion. I think the volatility, the vulnerability. And then there's a hardcore band from New York called Ache. And the singer, Ryan Bland, wrote a poem about Dave that he performed, like with tears in his eyes. And Ache sounds like Bad Brains times 10. It's some of the heaviest music I've ever heard in my life. And I am honored and somewhat shocked that these younger men who are in these incredibly heavy, very articulate, but very, very heavy band, love Majesty Crush.
Yeah.
And it's always been like, you know, there was that story that Slash told that, like, you know, when Lenny Kravitz's record came out, it was all the Sunset Strip hair metal rockers. That was the record they'd put on for date night with their lady, you know, because it was a little sexier and softer.
Yeah.
You know, Slash famously told Lenny Kravitz, hey, my girl and I, you know, make love to your record all the time. He probably didn't use the term make love. But I think that's somehow Crush has kind of become that. You know, we've become the kind of like the emotional, the vulnerable, the kind of wear your heart on your sleeve band for people that like extreme emotions, but that also recognize there's a different version than just louder. You know what I mean? Yeah. And they appreciate it. And I think that's been a huge part of where we're sort of, we're getting people to listen to us now. It's bizarre.
I do want to go back to Insane Clown Posse and ask you this question as a ghostwriter of a book about them. Maybe you can answer this. I remember when they got signed to Hollywood Records.
Yep.
They put the album out. And as the album was coming out, it got pulled off the shelf because Disney said, we had no idea what this was all about. Yep. I remember
it was
that
a sacrificial lamb. It's exactly what it happened to Insane Clown Posse. sign to a major label after having a large degree of independent success, and then right as it's supposed to come out, they get dropped. It's exactly what happened to us. But basically, the way it plays out is that Hollywood Records was owned by Disney, and Disney was coming under heat for some of its politics. So they kind of made Insane Clown Posse the sacrificial lamb. They knew all along what it sounded like.
Yeah.
But the label had to appease, like, I forget, it was the Southern Baptist something that said Disney didn't espouse family values. And they decided to choose ICP as kind of like the sacrificial lamb.
What you said about
them. And that's really the story, huh?
What you said about them. I mean, I remember when that happened and I thought to myself, if I was starting a label today, I would hire those guys to be in my marketing department, right? Because the album got pushed, the album got sent out with the Hollywood label into record stores. As soon as it was announced that it was being pulled off the shelves, everybody went to go buy it. And then a week later, it came out without the Hollywood label. And then everybody went out to buy a second copy so they could have two copies. Yeah. I'm like, that's brilliant. That's the kind of person I want as my marketing person, is going out and figuring out how to sell double the amount of records. And to your point,
fans will buy everything. ICP was famous for putting out, they had the record, the Jekyll Brothers. There were two different versions of the records.
Oh, yeah.
ICP tap into that audience of people who love music that's collectible. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And one of the things they do, if you ever go to hatchetware.com or whatever it's called, ICP is the kind of band that not only has a t-shirt for every one of their records, they have a hockey jersey, a baseball jacket. They have every kind of merchandise you can imagine, lighters, underwear, posters. They know their audience. Absolutely. And the thing that I always used to say, I compare it to Nine Inch Nails. You probably heard this story. Nine Inch Nails are the opening act on the very first Lollapalooza. Nine Inch Nails sold more t-shirts than every other band combined. That's what ICP did very, very well. They tap into an audience that is going to buy everything they do and collect it and participate in the band. And before you write that off as like brash capitalism, I call it serving your fan base and your audience.
For sure.
Like, I love Was Not Was, and I loved Everybody Do the Dinosaur, but there was nothing about it that made you want to engage it further. You know, ICP is a band. They have their own wrestling league. You know, they have a convention every year, the Gathering of the Juggalos
in Ohio.
They will do recreations of their albums the way Civil War reenactors recreate battles. They are geniuses of knowing that they have a fan base. And they are able to invigorate that fan base utterly and perfectly. And I mean, that's frankly why I used to catch so much crap for, like, I mean, what's really funny is, I think I told you, there was that, you know, college roommate of mine, Mike Rubin. Well, he went on to write for Spin Magazine, and he wrote a very, very sarcastic article about ICP, about how horrible they were. And then he confided in me, shocked, that all the fans were like calling up everybody with his last name, and some of them were his relatives, and saying, you know, you better not say anything bad about our band, you know, whatever. Yeah. And I'm like, why did you poke that animal, man? Why, what did you think? You just called a band's fan base stupid.
Yeah.
You tried to be an arbiter of a train that already left the station, which is, it's already successful. Why did you feel the need to tell the world how whack it is? Like, what does that accomplish? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that's when that kind of sarcastic gatekeeping, today ICP is totally revered, you know? Mm-hmm. But one of the funnest things to do in the year 2000 was run around New York City. And I, you know, I was in some fairly, I lived in New York in 2000, but I was in some fairly, you know, I knew all the guys from Vice Magazine, and I wrote for the Village Voice, and you know, I would have been considered on the edge of what were the cool writers, some of the cool writers. I knew the writers from Rolling Stone. I had one piece there. And I was running around. I was writing about Insane Clown Posse. Seriously, you know, and everybody's like, that's a joke, man. That's like I'm getting idiot shivers just thinking about it. You know, that's something I wouldn't even touch. And I'm like, no, man, it's super successful. It's, you know, there. And Mike Clark, the guy who produced my old band Spawn Ranch and produced the first Majesty Crush, produced all their records.
Yeah.
So I was always aware of them. I always knew Joe and Joey. I mean, I still know. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I've recently gotten back in touch with Joe over Instagram. We're talking about maybe doing another book, to be honest, you know, because they have a whole other story about their survival. But you can't, you know, it's kind of like Taylor Swift. Like, my daughter loves Taylor Swift. I love that my daughter loves Taylor Swift.
Yeah.
Taylor Swift is not for old white men to argue the validity of. No one cares. You know what I mean? Right. I mean, I know what I was into when I was her age. And I wish I had somebody that served my fan base needs as much as, you know, like I said, I had to get my Doors record from the public library.
Yeah.
So it's kind of funny, you know, but that's the way stuff worked, you know, but that's the thing. Like, we're buds, like, you know, ICP, our producer's the same guy who produced ICP. I completely see parallels and I absolutely will defend them, you know?
Yeah. And another thing you mentioned, a Detroit band that sounded like you were from the UK that had two black guys in the band. That reminds me of the band The Velt.
Oh yeah. Love
very,
them.
Very similar, right? I mean, very similar. Unexpected. They're from the Carolinas, I think, right? North Carolina, South Carolina.
And did a record in 1993 that disappeared and just came out.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
The thing they did with Robin Guthrie.
Gobstopper.
Gobstopper. Right. Yeah. And it's brilliant. It's beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. And I saw them, I think it was last year I saw them. They played a really small little hole in the wall. And I chatted with them real briefly afterwards. And both the brothers, both are named Danny and Daniel, right?
Yeah, Danny and Daniel.
I was talking to one of them and he said,
"Go figure."
Yeah, he said something like, I work at the Hilton. I work in the restaurant at the Hilton and I take 2 weeks off every year and we just hit in a van and we go everywhere we can. And then we come back and I go back to, but he's like, it's in my blood. I can't stop doing it.
Oh yeah. They live it, you know, and that's a good, you know, it's so interesting. I'm glad you brought them up because the parallels are intense.
Yeah.
Right down to having a left-handed white bass player. I mean, the parallels are bizarre, right?
Yeah.
The UK sounding, being black, having a record shelved in 1993 that comes back out. The parallels are amazing. What I've learned through communicating with them is that it is in their blood. And what's beautiful is their commitment to the culture. And what they've done, and that Love 15 kind of did, it. And this is a parallel that I'm just making now. They were making the case that what they were doing that we would now call shoegaze, or the production touch of Robin Guthrie, really tied to a much larger tradition of psychedelic rock, 60s rock, classic rock. It was just a different take on it because maybe some different chords and sounds.
Mm-hmm.
But the longevity is classic in nature.
Yes.
Like Arthur Lee in Love. You know what I mean? That kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And what I see them now as, because they have so much beautiful vintage equipment, and the way they dress and their style, mm-hmm. is they're really kind of doing something that, like, Jimi Hendrix and Lenny Kravitz, they're kind of cutting a line through rock and roll, and they're owning the black identity of rock and roll and black rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear them so much more than a shoegaze band. Have you seen that KEXP thing they just did?
No.
So they did a whole live thing. And this is like you're saying, like seeing it all in the wall. This is, yeah, I think it's like three cameras in a very small room and they just play.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful.
Yeah.
But you hear it and you really realize you are not seeing a band from 1993 that's still a band. You're seeing a band that has cut through the history of rock and roll like other pioneers and African Americans have.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes me back to Dave turning me on to Pink Floyd. You know, Dave saw a connection to what he was doing with Syd Barrett era Pink Floyd. You know, I hear Danny and Daniel, they're cutting through everything and they're going back to a tradition of rock and roll that they're living, you know, in their style, in their band, in their sound. And I think that's what's kind of beautiful about it. The fact that they're still doing it makes them classic, mm-hmm. but the audience they're finding is definitely the shoegaze audience. See, when I hear that shoegaze is big and it's still big, what I hear is an open-mindedness I hear a less masculine take on rock and roll and guitar. I hear a feminization of music, a vulnerability of music, an openness of music that I love and that I've always connected with. Something a little darker, maybe a little brighter, maybe a little more opaque, but everything about it was, it didn't tell me how to feel about it. It gave me room to grow within it and with it. Mm-hmm. And that's the stuff. Like we always used to say, the reason 4AD bands were so big in Detroit was, if you've ever been in Detroit in like February and March, when it's freezing cold and the snow is mostly gray, and maybe there's freezing rain, but then it snows again, and it's a Sunday afternoon, and you're listening to the Cocteau Twins, it sounds pretty freaking perfect.
Right.
Because I remember the first time I ever came to LA, and I was staying in Laguna Beach, and I could hear the waves, and I could see the sun, and I'm like, you guys don't need the Cocteau Twins out here. You have it right outside. The waves are the Cocteau Twins. The sun is her voice. You don't need this kind of music. If you're in the Midwest and it's empty, you want to fill that little space. You want to be that light in the window, right?
Yeah.
That's the music we always made. It was the light in the window on the dark street.
Yes.
That was kind of the aesthetic. And I think that's kind of the aesthetic that all this stuff kind of meets, you know? And that's what I think the Velt does very well. They do it much more, you know, it's kind of how I mentioned, once the record label went, we were on our own and we were more aggressive and angry. We wrote Sane and JFA were still together. Mm-hmm. The Velt kind of have been writing more, they've been writing sort of some louder, bigger songs all along. Because I think their identity is so much as a live touring animal.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's what makes them so great. Like, I think if we would have stayed a band 30 years later, we'd be about at their level as far as the pitch and the articulation. Because that's the thing that always impresses me about the Velt. They are at level 10 as soon as they plug in. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
there's no beating around the bush. And you can call it shoegaze all you want. To me, it's rock and roll. You know what I mean? Because it is up there. He is singing his heart out every goddamn song. You know what I mean? And that's something that I think is very Dave, but we just didn't have, we only had 4 years together. So we didn't have the time to turn it into something like that. You know what I mean?
Did the label thing, did you see any money out of that? I mean, like when you signed?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was Detroit money. Let me explain what Detroit money is. We got X amount of money for signing with the label, and we got X amount of the money for signing a publishing deal with Warner Music, where 50% of our publishing royalties would go to Warner Music based on taking this advance. And the kind of money we got back then was, I was working as a music journalist. I was an editor at the Metro Times, which was our, I think you guys have the New Times or something like that. It's the free newspaper that has all the punk rock ads in it, right?
Yeah.
I was making about what I would make there in a year, plus enough that we bought a van. So we had money to live on for about a year and a half. And that's the way they did deals back then. They gave you kind of seed money based on performance. And, you know, it's I'm interested. Why is there a reason you asked that question? Is this again about the business thing?
Well, no, because as part of this whole idea of Dig Me Out 90s. I mean, I think that there was the impression, at least when I was in college in the 90s, Nirvana hits. And then even in Columbus, we had people from Interscope and Atlantic and Sony showing up and coming to see, like you would know. I mean, they weren't gross, sick New York people, but you could tell, like, these people are here carefully paying attention to see if this is a band they want to sign. And I think my assumption back in the 90s was that everybody's getting a record deal and they're getting good money because Nirvana paved the way. And so I think the reality is, as I knew some guys in a band that were, they were on Atlantic Records called Fig Dish. They sold like 3,000 CDs. When they weren't touring, they were all waiting tables and working in restaurants. And
Of course.
But I was like, you guys are rock stars. You're signed to Atlantic Records.
No, man. There was none of that back then. No.
That's why I ask. I mean, I think the assumption was that all you guys got.
One of the reasons they were able to sign so many bands was the deals were tiny.
Yeah.
We're talking, I mean, a band of our level would get about $100,000, $25,000 per member. And that was what started the deal. Yeah. And then if it performed, you'd renegotiate. These weren't three record deals guaranteed. They were based on performance. Yeah. And again, you know, you probably have seen that book. I think Steve Albini wrote that book called something like, you know, some, or that article, This Is Why All Your Friends and Bands Are Screwed. Basically talked about how every band that did take a bunch of money just wound up owing that for the first 3 or 4 years. And this happens in every industry. You've heard about this, you know, the band TLC, the hip hop group had the same thing. It's, you take all this money up front, but then you're paying for everything. You're paying for the dinners. You're paying to get on the, you're not to get on the, but you know what I mean? There's a lot of promotions being done. Sure. There are huge budgets with that. Like, it doesn't start from nowhere. And, you know, something that needs to be addressed here is that how valuable that is and how much better it is right now. Like, I'm going to totally, like, bow down to the power of Numero.
Yeah.
Most of these people that are DMing us have found out about us because Numero put us on a playlist or did ads that attracted these people in the digital age.
Yeah.
So we are getting people drawn to us as a new audience through the power of what these labels are doing that we're paying back by selling records. So I am totally like, you do your job very well, and we are very grateful. And I think what happened back then was, you know, in the 60s and 70s, there was much more money, and you'd have one band that was making all the money so they could afford to artists develop these other ones. And ultimately, if one or two really took off, there was so much money, nobody cared. But in the 90s, it became much more granular accounting wise. And because it became granular accounting wise, you couldn't necessarily keep throwing money at a band that wasn't performing. So that's why you did have all these deals where a band came out and they, you know, it could be, dude, Chad, it could be something as simple as you lost the publicist at the label that really liked you. They got fired or they went somewhere else. Suddenly no one's pitching you. Now you're not coming up in marketing meetings. Now you don't have your marketing budget. Now your manager's calls aren't getting returned. And that's what happened back then. You had to have all these things in place. You look at any history of any successful band in the 90s, they all had a manager. They had a publicist, totally a publicist. You know, Nine Inch Nails, Suzy from Magnum PR, boom, right there. I mean, these are synonymous.
Yep.
That was huge. You had the same management, you had the booking agents, you had that infrastructure. And that's the thing, is the labels, you know, they didn't want to work with you if you didn't have all that stuff. And I don't blame them. You didn't want to call some guy. You wanted somebody who was a dedicated professional who understood that it was an industry, you know, that it was a business, you know? And that's something that I think the 90s industry, I love that they did that. I love that they gave us 20 albums by 20 bands never to be heard again, as opposed to taking 20 albums worth of music, putting it in one band that maybe we all know, but we don't care about now.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's what they did. And that's why your town was crawling with this. They knew they weren't going to get the next big thing, but if they were just throwing around 50 or 100 grand, they could probably get it back and have a nice little, you know, some of it would work, some of it wouldn't.
Yeah.
You know, they were basically diversifying, you know, and that's the thing that I find, you know, everybody puts it down. Oh, this signing frenzy, whatever. You're talking to me right now because of it. You know what I mean? So I have no hatred for it. Yeah. If anything, I admire the fact that the industry took such a huge chance on so many bands, you know.
Yeah.
And although, yes, maybe their expectations in hindsight seemed a little bit imbalanced, we got a lot of great stuff from it. And it's still, you know, we're still rediscovering all this stuff, you know.
The story,
I'm absolutely a fan, you know.
Yeah, the story that I read, right, is that you guys showed up basically, didn't you, like, pull up to the label and they're like, oh, yeah, you guys are done. And
oh, it's much more cryptic than that. We're in New York. We're flying high. We're playing this gig at Brownies. We're part of the industry now, man. We got a record out. And we're playing with this group, the Moist Boys. Who are the Moist Boys?
Ween
side project. Yeah. Side project, the Ween. Everybody cool in New York is. And we're like, man, all these people are here. It's at Brownies in New York. And Moist Boys are like, hey, can we play through your stuff? We kind of have to split afterwards. Yeah, no problem, man. It's so many people here. It's a great gig. Yeah, of course you can use our stuff. We're the headliner. They play, everybody leaves. They go see Nirvana Unplugged. It was the same night. Everybody there was from the record industry.
Yeah.
And if they were there to see us, they wanted to see Nirvana Unplugged better. They all left. Yeah. We play in front of 15, 20 people. We're demoralized. My buddy Don lives down the street on the Bowery, right across from CB's. And the next morning, we get a call from our A&R guy, and he's like, I got some bad news. Oh, okay, what up? Well, the label isn't a label anymore. Oh, okay. Yeah, and the Bob Buziak, the chairman, he resigned. There's one guy there left, the vice guy. You didn't hear it from me, but if you guys pull up in your van today, you can get as much stuff as you can carry as far as posters, promotional cassettes and CDs and finished CDs. So we literally go up to Midtown, double park the damn van with the hazards on, and we go upstairs and we raid the office, and that's it. That was the end of our affiliation with that label.
Yeah.
And it was the night after Nirvana Unplugged.
I mean, yeah, you've got a story, man. This would be a great movie. I mean, not a great movie.
It's kind of like this. Our first time in New York, right? We're going down St. Mark's Place because my buddy lives on the Bowery right across from CBGB's. Yeah. If you were producing a movie, you couldn't get a more perfect place. Let's have the band live across from CBGB's in a loft. We're going down. Who cuts in front of us? Darcy from the Smashing Pumpkins. We're like, oh my God, this is the world we're in, man. It's like Darcy's on the street. You know, we know the Pumpkins through the band Catherine because we played with Catherine, who was Darcy's husband's band. Right. And so, you know, Billy was at shows that we played. I'm not going to say he was a fan of ours in any way, shape, or form, but we knew him. We knew of him. James, the guitar player, was dating a girl from our hometown, blah, 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 blah. They had a lot of Midwestern. Mm-hmm. They had a lot of ties to Detroit, right? So we figure we're in that world, you know, and we mixed our record in Madison, Wisconsin with Butch Vig's drum tech, Mr. Olson, a guy by the name of Doug Olson.
Oh, yeah.
And he's mixing our record in the studio where Butch Vig did some of his great recordings. And on our third or fourth day there, Butch Vig comes in. He comes off a red eye from L.A. and he introduces himself, and you can tell he's been up all night. And he's like, I have a DAT tape. I just finished this record. Do you guys mind? I know you're in the studio mastering your record. Could I just listen to this record? And we're like, yeah, sure. Do you mind us asking where it is? He goes, yeah, it's the new Pumpkins record. We're like, how do you like your eggs, Butch? Of course, of course. Here, of course. He puts it in, and it's, you know, the used to be a little boy. Like, it's, what is that? It's
the Siamese Dream album, right?
Siamese Dream.
Yeah.
It's goddamn Siamese Dream. It's a freaking masterpiece. Dave and I are looking at each other. Butch Vig is kind of going, now remember, Butch Vig has produced our friends' records, Laughing Hyenas.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is a name we know who now is massive from Nirvana. But again, we're somehow in this world. And Butch starts to look at us and he goes, do you think I should have, like, as if we know, should I made this hi-hat? Like, he just said something and he goes, man, I could totally go back and work on this. And we're kind of looking at each other. Dave and I were like, no, Butch, this sounds amazing. Dave, right? Dave, tell him. Looks, it's amazing. We're like talking Butch Vig off a ledge about the Smashing Pumpkins record. These guys in Majesty Crush, who a year before are selling their t-shirts and CDs after gigs with a record we did ourselves in a side room with ICP's producer on budgeted time. And we're in the Butch Vig world, you know, we're in the Pumpkins world. And then that night, we're in the Ween world. We're in the Nirvana Unplugged world, even if it took our whole audience away. And then the next day, we're back on the street. That's what it was like. You felt like you were part of something, but as you know, as the saying goes, this too shall pass, and it passed, you know? And that's how that stuff worked. And it went away really, really fast. I mean, you know, 90% of things back then was distribution and promotion. How much money are they going to put into getting your records in the stores that they will sell? It was a two-pronged assault, marketing and distribution. And that's what major labels do. And we suddenly didn't have it, you know? So every college radio person who liked us had it, and they continued to play us. And we would book these gigs, and we would meet the three or four record store clerks in every town who liked us. and they'd bring five or six of their friends to the show. And that's pretty much what comprised, you know, kind of like our touring history, you know, until we got back to Detroit.
How long did the band last after that?
Well, that was a thing. We decided to keep going, but it was rough, you know, because it was two really bad things happened. One, we didn't have a label, but two, we had a lot of money. So suddenly we're sitting around all day. Our job is to write music, but for who and what, you know? Mm-hmm. So what we did is that summer we wound up touring. We played a bunch of shows. In summer 94, we recorded the Sans Muscles record, which I said has some of our most aggressive material. It also has probably our best shoegaze song. It's called Space Between Your Moles. And then shortly after that, I left the band, and then Dave kind of picked up guitar, and a friend of ours, Craig Thornton, joined on bass, and they kind of wrote a lot of new material because they had a new bass player and Dave was playing more guitar, and they kind of soldiered on. They played CMJ. Mm-hmm. They played New York. They toured with The Verve, you know, but it was all, you know, it was all bittersweet, mm-hmm. you know. They did a showcase show that I actually went to. I thought it was a great show. But, you know, the Majesty Crush that we built for 4 years wasn't the Majesty Crush that went on the eight months to a year after I left it. It just was too different. And I'm going to say it's because I was, you know, I was, I quote Kevin Monroe from the Laughing Hyenas. He's quoted as saying he wrote bass lines that were so catchy and hooky and important that they couldn't kick him out of the band because they needed his bass lines. I hate to say it, you know, and this is, you're talking to the bass player of this band,
sure.
But it was kind of like that, you know? We were four musicians that played very well with each other. We weren't necessarily great on our own, but we really gelled really well together. And it was something that was often very combustible and very spirited, and it became kind of crazy. But the beautiful part about it was when it worked, it really worked. And even when it was really tested, we still came out with a record like Sans Muscles. And then after I left, they wound up doing a live record that was ironically enough released with the name P.S. I Love You, which was Dave's band after Majesty Crush that I actually played drums in. So I don't want to get too confusing with the family tree. All you got to know is that Dave and I made up and we wound up making music as P.S. I Love You, and I played drums on the P.S. I Love record, Heart of Stone, and, you know, whatever. But basically, it was just hard to keep the momentum going because we didn't have the booking agent. We didn't have the manager. The Velt actually reached out to us to tour, but it was after we'd broken up, ironically enough, you know?
So what... Mike and Odell, they go, like, did you guys kind of all spread out after this, or were we all still hanging around Detroit?
Well, no, it happened very, very organically. Odell promptly moved to New York and went to law school and became a prominent music attorney. You know, Michael was a graphic designer. He became a groundbreaking graphic designer for a little label out of the Midwest called Ghostly International. That is now a huge New York-based electronic music label that was founded in Ann Arbor, Michigan. The irony was, I wrote the first review of a Ghostly International record called Hands Up for Detroit when I lived in New York, and I wrote for Mixer magazine, which was the U.S. version of Mix Mag UK, and Michael designed the record cover.
Wow.
So we were suddenly the old guys, you know, having more of a vestigial relationship with the new generation of music coming out of Detroit.
Yeah.
And Odell became a huge techno fan. He goes to festivals all over the world and stuff. And he's now a very prominent music attorney in New York.
Yeah.
So it was very organic that we broke up and went our different ways. You know, I mean, I may have been a bit pissy and quit prematurely, and they did go on. But all that did was give Dave an excuse to pick up the guitar and become a primary songwriter. And that's what P.S. I Love You was.
Yeah.
And then when I played with him in P.S. I Love You, I mostly played the drums, you know.
And that was based in L.A.?
No, that was based in Detroit.
Oh, okay.
So you can find it on the streaming services. It's called Heart of Stone. The big single was called Where the F is Kevin Shields, about this. It was basically saying, where's the follow-up to Loveless from My Bloody Valentine? It was a joke. It's kind of a fun novelty song. It got big in England. There's a picture of John Peel, that John Peel, the BBC radio DJ, Peel Sessions John Peel. He's wearing a t-shirt with a big glass of wine. And the t-shirt, Dave took a Motown label and he doctored it to say, P.S. I Love You. And the songs are Where the F is Kevin Shields. The B-side of the record is No Sharks Allowed. I played drums on that. I actually played keyboards on Where the F is Kevin Shields, but Dave took my keyboard parts off of it to make it a little more straight ahead, because Dave did stuff like that back then. But I'm the drummer on the B side, and then the record is called Heart of Stone, and I play the drums on that record.
The fact that you mentioned that, I had forgotten. I'm sure I've heard that, because I don't know if you were like me with the internet, right? Like, the internet wasn't really around in the early 90s. And by the time it got to be the later 90s and we started getting the ability to search on stuff, that was very much of the dig. I was digging. I was trying to find out what happened to Majesty Crush, right? You guys were not around anymore. And I know at some point I came across a P.S. I Love You stuff. I may have downloaded it from somewhere. I know that, but I had totally forgotten that until now. That was, what year was that? Like early 2000s?
Yeah, and Dave was very active in like messaging boards, and he also had a job in New York as a stringer for MTV News. So he would interview Liam Gallagher when he came through. And on message boards, Dave would communicate with Richard Ashcroft from The Verve, and he'd communicate with Jason from Spaceman 3 and Spiritualized.
Yeah.
And he became, you know, you can imagine what his presence was like in England. It was this really outspoken kind of mercurial black guy from Detroit whose music didn't sound that different from these artists that he was communicating with in England. So Dave became something of a sensation, you know. And of course, the label Rocket Girl put out the song Where the F is Kevin Shields, and it became like a novelty hit at the time, you know. So you're right. That was right at the era when things became viral and things became what they became. And Dave was right there with it, you know. And then Dave moves to Los Angeles. We had some contact, but nothing really musically. And then in the late 2000s, he makes a record with Will Carruthers from Spaceman 3 and Jonathan Wald, who records under the name Perplexic Music. And that album kind of becomes the record Dear Kate, but there's a better version of it with different songs and different mixes, including an incredible version of Voodoo Child by Jimi Hendrix that doesn't sound anything like it. I'll send it to you, but it's bizarrely good. But the point is that he does make a whole album, but then his mental health and legal troubles start to get the best of him. He winds up not being able to travel to England. He winds up with a couple of arrests. He winds up without a permanent address, so he doesn't have access to medication or resources for his mental illness. And things just gradually decline through the 2010s, basically. And then we know what happens in 2017. He's killed in an officer-involved shooting. So, you know, it's really sad. He had done music all the way up to the end. In the days before his final trip to Los Angeles from Barstow, which is east of L.A., he was recording Beatles songs on an acoustic guitar and sending them as voice memos to Jonathan. I know. Yeah.
I mean, it goes back to the internet. I lost, you know, whatever happened, and I ended up reading that news, and it was sort of shocking, you know, just sort of shocking to learn about all that stuff that happened.
Well, the thing about it was, and you know, I don't want to. This is definitely a part of our story, right?
Yeah.
And a part of our story is you talked about seeing the Velt and about how they still bring it, even if it's for 2 weeks a year. Yeah. Dave still wanted to bring it. And he always had this thing in his mind. And he just kept thinking the way to do this was to become more extreme and more what Dave was. What made Majesty Crush great was his volatility, his combustibility, but also the heart that was under it, right? He was a guy that could take a really troubling subject like obsession, and he could give it kind of a voice and make it likable, even if today it almost might seem troublesome. But he was good at that, you know? I would liken it to like the way, say, Prince or The Weeknd writes very erotic lyrics, very feminine lyrics sometimes, but makes them very likable and enjoyable, even if they're a little risque and a little crazy at times.
Right.
I think what he did is his personality kept going in that direction, but navigating mental health, limited access to resources, the ability to support yourself. I mean, what the guy did for a living was flip cars that he would buy at auctions. And I'm talking like $500 cars that had been towed away. He could buy it and somehow fix it up and sell it for $2,000. He was a master of doing that. He would drive from LA to Detroit and back in a car that he had bought for $500. The guy was a genius at doing that stuff.
Yeah.
Such a genius that he got to the level where he could go to the $1,000 auctions and get the better cars to flip. I mean, he drove around a Porsche that didn't have a windshield for like 6 months. You know what I mean? That was what he did, you know? So I love the guy. You know, I even saw him out here once I had my kid, like in 2007. And he was Dave, and he comes down in a Mustang 5.0 convertible where the convertible top didn't work and it was belching smoke. I remember putting my baby in the baby seat in the back and going over to my brother's house. And Dave was in his full rock and roll regalia, you know, wearing women's clothes and had a head wrap with sunglasses on it and like a sleeveless blouse or whatever.
Yeah.
And my brother, who's a little more conservative with me, is like, is he going to be here long? Like, we got key people coming over. And I'm like, it's Dave. And my brother looks at me like, it is Dave, but you and I aren't Dave anymore. We're like dads in cargo shorts with babies. You know what I mean? And I kind of got his point, you know?
Yeah.
Dave never lost that quality, you know? And it's the thing that was kind of so sad was that he never lost the vision or the energy. He just lost the tools and the access to the resources that it took to make everything happen, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, he always had great musicians, you know. The fact that he made a record with the bass player for Spaceman 3 is huge.
Yeah, yeah.
It's huge. That's beautiful. That's a total testament to Dave's talent, you know. But at the same time, too, there was the other part of it that, you know, in Detroit, we could keep it under control because he always had the purpose. He had a house, you know. We had shows. We had records. We had fans. He was much more on his own out here. And I think without anything to steady him, it just led to a gradual unraveling. And you cannot underestimate not having access to your resources like medication and treatment.
Yeah.
You know, you can't underestimate that. And I think that's ultimately what happened, man. You know?
So gets us to 2024, like Numero Group, like how does this all come about?
It's very funny. Okay, so this is all true and all weird. And again, movies aren't even this simple. This actually goes back to 20.
Give me a second.
Yep.
It goes back actually to, give me a second, let me plug in my ear. It actually goes back to 2022.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah. It goes back to 2018.
Okay.
So within one weekend, four significant events happen. First of all, a friend of mine from Detroit named Dennis White, who is now a huge house music producer in LA called LaTroit, and he's won a Grammy. When in Detroit, he was in a band called Charm Farm that was a huge fan of Detroit. These are guys that went to Berklee School of Music and they wanted to form a band that was a cross between like Prince and INXS. So they were great musicians who knew how to write great pop songs. And they saw in us a raw talent that they loved. They would have us play with them all the time. I think they loved that we were all kind of these larger than life characters that were all kind of crazy, especially Dave. But they were like really good musicians and they had really good taste. Well, in 2018, Dennis, he had covered Number One Fan on a project back in 2007 called A Love Supreme. He covered Number One Fan for a Valentine's Day like release that he was doing as a side project. And it was actually under the name, what was it? Something Freak. But it was a side project. So he knew our music. He actually covered our music. In 2018, he goes, hey, man, who owns your masters? You guys need to put your music back out and get it in TV and film. It just seems like the sound would be perfect right now. And I'm like, yeah, well, I don't know where our masters are. I don't know if we own it, but what a great idea. Cut to the next day, I get this random message from Dave's sister saying, you know, it's been bugging me since my brother died last year. But is there any way we can get like Third Man Records to like put out the music? I just think it would be a really good idea. Like, I don't even know where to start, but that seems the first logical thing. And I go, that's a great idea. The next day I'm checking my Facebook message and there's a random message from a housewife in like Duluth, Minnesota. And it says, I think I have your masters. And there's a picture of the master tapes that Dave and I took to Smart Studios in Wisconsin to master the record with Butch Vig's drum tech. The story goes, Dave had taken them to LA. He'd been hauling them all over the country. He left them in a roommate's closet. Dave started getting into trouble, never got them again. Well, anyway, that roommate wound up passing away. All his stuff got sent to his next of kin, who were in the Midwest. And the lady, for some reason, had a friend of a friend who knew me and said, hey, I think I have your master tapes. And they were indeed the Love 15 master tapes.
Wow.
No, gets better. Then on Monday, hi, my name's Rich Hansen. You may not remember me. I used to do a bunch of shows with you guys and Matchstick Crush and Spawn Ranch. Third Man Records wants me to do a compilation of space rock bands from Detroit, Michigan, and your name is at the top of the list. Do you know where your masters are? It gets better. 2 weeks later, Third Man Records announces they're opening up a mastering studio. And the mastering engineer is Warren DeFever from His Name is Alive, who is the band we did our first shows with, who is on 4AD Records. And oh, by the way, this mastering studio even has a 30-year-old 2-inch mastering tape machine to pull 2-inch tape off of. And our record was on that antiquated format 2-inch tape. So I know if it sounds too good to be true, it was. But one guy said, it would be really cool if you had your masters. Dave's sister goes, let's talk to Third Man. A lady finds our masters and gets them to us. Third Man wants to do the song, and they have a mastering studio. And then the way it goes from there is that Rich Hansen actually took our music to Numero and made them aware of it. Now, I had already known Numero because I wrote about, as I mentioned, that record called Downriver Revival. So the guy remembered me, and we had some mutual friends out here in LA. So Numero had started to do a bunch of early 90s bands like Duster and Codeine.
Yeah.
But it was there's partners. And Rob mostly did the funk and soul. He hadn't really done any alternative rock band. And so he saw Majesty Crush because he already knew me and he was already aware of the music. He saw this, I think, as something that he could bring to the table, that Numero was starting to do more 90s indie rock type stuff. Mm-hmm. And it just seemed like a marriage made in heaven, you know? And Odell and Rob are like great friends now because I think Rob has a deep respect for Odell as a music lawyer. And Odell as a music lawyer knows how great Rob and Numero are as a label, you know? So it kind of worked out perfectly. I mean, at one point, I think we all thought it would be logical to come out on Third Man Records, but I kind of realized with the way Third Man works, you know, they can only do so much, you know? Now they're doing a lot of great old jazz records, And I think on the Numero label, we hold it kind of a special place because that's a record, that's a label that's really good with bands that have a great story, and we have a great story, you know. Sure. Even if it's a tragedy, we have a great story, you know. We lost our record label and then we lost our singer, you know what I mean? And that's the kind of stuff Numero's really good with, is just telling the story. You know, they win Grammys for their packaging. They win Grammys for how they present the music as like a, I always joke, you should get college, you should get community college credit whenever you listen to a Numero record because you learn so much.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Were you throughout the 2000s, before all this stuff, were you keeping, not or maybe you were keeping it publicly, the name alive, Majesty Crush? Were you out there talking about it?
Not at all. It was like, is this the most you've talked about? I never mentioned it. I didn't think it was a big deal. It was almost embarrassing to say, oh yeah, my band from the 90s.
Yeah.
I didn't say a damn thing. The only time it became relevant, ironically enough, there's a wonderful comedian named J. Chris Newberg, and he did a record in, I think, 2007 or 8. And he borrowed my Majesty Crush t-shirt because he wanted the model on the cover of his record to be wearing a Majesty Crush t-shirt, which I still haven't gotten back. That was about as popular as the band was. It was like verboten. You know, I'll give you a good, for instance, when I moved to LA, I brought a bag of records and I promptly got a job as a cool hotel lobby DJ because I was a journalist who had a lot of cool records. One record I would always play was Leave Them All Behind by Ride. I've always loved the song. I've loved the bass line. I've loved the playing. I've loved the band. And I would play this in the lobby of the Standard Hotel. And I would play it, and I knew no one would like it or know it because this was like in the year 2003, 2004, 2005. By 2007, it was on their in-house playlist. I would come into work and hear it already playing.
Yeah.
So somehow the shoegaze sound suddenly became real again. It wasn't just neo-nostalgia.
Sure.
You know? And I think that's, personally, I always thought the fact that I was in a band at one time was kind of, I don't want to say embarrassing, but I didn't lead with that. I was a writer. I was a yoga teacher. I was a DJ. I just happened to play in a band in the 90s. It's not till now that I've ever been really able to appreciate and articulate, one, how good I think the band was, largely because of the contributions by everybody but me. Like, I think Michael and Odell, there's songs I listen to now, like Odell's drums on JFA We're Still Together are amazing. I never complimented him back then, because I just didn't think to. But now I listen to him like, this is amazing. And Dave's lyrics, we never sat down and talked about the lyrics and analyzed them. Now I realize they're really great. They're really just take you somewhere. And so now I am very proud of it. And I kind of lead with it. It's something, I don't DJ a lot now. Right now, my business is to help promote this record, which is something that a label believes in enough to make this something that they want to put out and have us participate in it. And I'm totally honored to be part of it. I'm a bigger fan of it now than I was back then, because now I can see it with hindsight and go, it was a minor miracle this even existed. And it's an even more minor miracle that it's even happening again. But now it might finally reach an audience, you know?
Yeah.
It'll have a chance now that it never got in the first place, but the chance is better now.
For sure.
You know?
Is this the first time that it's been issued on vinyl? I mean, there was no vinyl back in the 90s. Yeah. Not very much.
There were 2 7-inches, which are included in the on the record. There's the Sunny Pie single with the early version of Chichilina.
Yeah.
And then there's what's called the Davies production of a song called Grow. Now, the Davies production of Grow is streaming, but it's not on vinyl. The Love 15 version of Grow is on vinyl, but the B-side, which is called Purr, is on. And we recorded this punk rock single in a basement in, I think, winter 1991 or winter January 1992. And we didn't think anything of it. Now it's one of the best things we ever did.
Yeah.
Because it's so raw and so like in your face. It sounds so good.
So I've read the product description. I have not seen the pack. I mean, I've seen the pictures of the package, but it says 24-page book.
Yeah.
Assuming that you as a journalist wrote it.
We hired a writer, Fred Thomas, who's a famous indie rock musician from Detroit. Yeah. He's legendary. He wrote it. I helped him write it. That we wrote together, but it's very heartfelt. It's a great history. It's got pictures that have never been seen before. It's got every single one of Dave's lyrics transcribed. And like I said, we didn't ever have this back then. We knew a couple lines and stuff, but now it's like, oh my God, this guy was an incredible vocalist and incredible lyricist.
Yeah.
And that's been huge. Like just how the, you know, I mean, I hate to say it, but like I'm such a huger fan of Dave now, seeing his work like preserved like this and held up like this, because we took it for granted back then. Yeah, he was a singer, but no bands doing this kind of music had a guy out front with a microphone singing. It was always a second guitar player with a mic in front of him. Right. You know, it was incredible. He was an incredible front man, an incredible lyricist, incredible singer. And I say incredible because he brought such a layer of emotion and detail and narrative and these characters he created and these personalities that he inhabited and he made sympathetic. You know, he wrote a song that was on regular rotation in mainstream radio. And the chorus was, "I'd kill the president for your love." And this was on commercial radio.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean, man?
Yeah.
I mean, I look back on it now. I'm like, somebody must have got fired for that, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, what the hell? It's so funny. But that's the thing. It's totally worth it. Because here's the deal. We were only around 4 years, but 4 years is a really good time to tell a story that has a beginning, a middle, and an end that you can get in two vinyl records and 24 pages of pictures, lyrics, and words. It's complete. Like you will inhabit our world, our thinking, our development, and our growth, and our, you know, our failures and our successes.
Yeah.
And that's what's so cool about it is Numero Group are geniuses at taking a music and making it like, I always joke, it's like a community college class.
Yeah.
But you walk away with such a deeper appreciation and understanding of what you're listening to, you know?
Yeah.
You learn so much.
Yeah.
So much.
Go ahead.
What were you going to say? This has been a what?
No, just a fantastic. I mean, it's not a lot. Some of the groups I talked to from the 90s did their 4 years and are completely, they don't get this final chapter, right? By the end of the 90s, they were they got dropped from labels and they were starting the getting married and having kids and getting, corporate jobs and stuff. And so it's very cool to be able to talk to you and I'm assuming you have a kind of puts a bow on the band. Like it gives you that last chapter. It gives you, it doesn't leave you hanging and you get some.
Well, obviously it's very bittersweet with the passing of Dave.
Sure.
But the beautiful thing about it is it's not so much a bow as it is the final, the package actually got wrapped and presented.
Yeah.
You know, the thing is, you can't underestimate is this is something that only reached a very core cult audience the first time. And in many ways, it's created this quantity over quality or quality over quantity appreciation of the music that now it's had enough time to kind of like gestate that now it's coming out to the world as a complete story.
Yeah.
That's like, maybe it's music that people are aware of, but I think the story in the world it comes out of will completely complete the picture of why this is worth your time and energy and why it came to be despite all its contradictions.
Yes.
You know what I mean? I mean, we were like a shoegaze band that wrote super poppy songs. You know, I was often performing looking like I was a member of Soundgarden because that's what we did at the time.
Sure.
A lot of bands took off their shirts back then. Remember Jane's Addiction, Soundgarden, you know, that was the Chili Peppers. It was a time when shirts weren't really a thing on stage.
right.
I was as guilty as anybody. But the point I'm trying to make is that this the way Numero's presented this, it's literally in black and white, as you can see it as this fully realized almost artistic and cultural statement that just happened to be this, you know, deeply unconventional and kind of contradictory band from Detroit, you know? And it's very sweet because very often, you know, like you said, bands don't get this kind of bow on top. They don't get this opportunity. And it sounds really awful to say, but it's almost like if we were going to happen, it would happen this way. It would take this much time. It would take being in a world where we do have things like Black Lives Matter, and we do have, we have bigger issues going on than just, hey, did a bunch of guys make some music that nobody heard? This speaks to bigger things about the record industry. It speaks to bigger things about culture. It speaks to bigger things about, you know, African-American identity. Mm-hmm. You know, it speaks to bigger issues.
Yeah.
And that's not the front and center, but that's totally part of it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I'm not trying to, I mean, you know, I'm an old white guy, right? But right. I can definitely say the black side of this, very real, both in the sense of what Dave grew up with. You know, he was friends with the nieces and nephews of Diana Ross. He was friends with T-Boy Ross, who wrote Marvin Gaye's I Want You. You know, his peers were Motown.
Yeah, yeah.
That's where he started, you know? And then he went to XML Deutschland, A.R. Kane, Pink Floyd, Syd Barrett. So this is a guy that held himself at a very high level, and Detroit and the history informed that utterly. And he identified with, you know, and that's something you couldn't say this 30 years ago.
Right. Right.
You know, 30 years ago, it'd be like, what would your dream tour be? You, the Smashing Pumpkins, and who else? That's the kind of questions back then.
Yeah.
Now we're, now everybody's a little more philosophical about music, I think.
Yeah.
You know, we can enjoy it more in the privacy of our own phones. You know what I mean? It's kind of funny. It's the truth though, isn't it?
No, absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely. Well, I think I'm out of questions. This has been a great history lesson. It's it helped me answer a lot of questions. Like I said, having owned the CD and the cassette, and like whatever happened to these guys, you know, it's the beauty of the internet era. But again, it's awesome that you're able to put this stuff out, and more people, you know, aren't going to have to randomly find this in a used bin or order it off Discogs. Like the music's going to be readily available, which is really very cool.
Well, and the beautiful thing is we have the record as its own statement. We have Crush Fan, who's this kid, Henry Boyer. He has a YouTube channel that's devoted to us. He literally has a timeline playlist of videos that are every interview we've ever done.
Wow.
And then he has a playlist of every live gig that was ever recorded, including three full shows on video, one from 1990 and two from 1993. So it's the kind of thing where, like, you don't have to try very hard to learn everything about this band, including what we were like live, what we sounded like.
Yeah.
And the Numero record is really, it's like the textbook, you know?
Yeah,
and then the field study is all the other stuff, but it's all there, you know? And that's something that we never had back then. We were like you in that basement with 200 other people seeing Greenhorn. You know what I mean? It was like, you were either there or you weren't, man. Now it's like, it's available to everybody. You know, and that's what's kind of beautiful.
Yeah.
And I do love that we're bringing back the double LP that you open up, you know, and you read the liner notes and you study the pictures as you listen to the music. And maybe you're wearing headphones or earbuds, but you got to get up and you got to turn over the record and you're making it into a session, you know?
Yep. Yep.
I really love that about it. It's finally getting, you know, I think you've really made it when you're like headphone rock. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because that's the true, that's like the purest way to enjoy music. If you're not in a room with 200 people, I want to be in headphones in my room on a rainy Sunday. You know what I mean?
Yep, absolutely.
That's kind of how it goes.
Well,
I can't thank you enough, man.
No,
I mean, when
you.
I heard Columbus, I was like, and that you'd seen us, I was like, wow, that's wild.
Well, again, thank you so much for your time. And
Columbus represent. Amen.
Yes. All right. Take it
easy. Okay, brother. All right. Thanks, man.
All right.
See you.